From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Social justice is playing a larger role in American higher education. A report unveiled recently in North Carolina explains why that's bad news for colleges and universities. When state lawmakers returned to Raleigh in January, some hoped they would tweak state tax law. You'll learn why they wanted North Carolinians to be able to take advantage of a federal change involving medical expenses. Some North Carolinians are playing a larger role in helping to write their local government's budgets. You'll learn how. And we'll discuss a proposed bill at the federal level that could threaten the gig economy in North Carolina and other states. Those topics are just ahead. But first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
Should a faculty member be forced to join a union if he or she doesn't want to? Well, that question is at the heart of a case that nearly two dozen public policy groups across the country, including the John Locke Foundation, want the U.S. Supreme Court to take up. John Guzet is Director of Legal Studies at the Locke Foundation. He joined us now to talk about this friend of the court brief to which the John Locke Foundation has signed on. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
So first of all, this is a workers' rights case here that we're talking about. So what has caught your eye and the eye of this organization, the Locke Foundation, about this case?
Well, the issue, as you said, is whether or not a public employee like Dr. Reisman can be forced to join a union and have them represent him and represent his interests in negotiations with the state against his will. If he doesn't even agree with what the union is doing, if he believes that the union is making statements that will be taken as if they are his statements, but he doesn't agree with them. That's what is at the heart of this case.
Well, evidently, this is a very serious situation to him because he is now part of this big case that is making its way through the federal court system. Give us a little bit of sense of what his situation is. He's in the state of Maine, I believe.
Yes. Well, his situation, and it's one that he has in common with public employees all over the country. The state has agreed to let a certain union represent these people, and whether or not, even, you know, as long as a certain number vote to be represented by this union, then they all have to be represented by the union. That's the problem for Dr. Reisman because he doesn't agree with what the union is trying to accomplish.
Tell us about the brief that we've signed on to. Essentially, what is the statement that it makes?
We want the Supreme Court to take this up. It's been submitted to the court, but of course the court has discretion about which cases it hears. And in this case, we think it's an important enough issue that they ought to take it up. It's been bouncing around the lower courts for a long time. The Supreme Court has already agreed that you can't force people like Dr. Reisman to pay for this speech, but you can still force them to be represented. And our feeling is that even if they're not paying for it, the fact that the union represents them means that the union speaks on their behalf. So this is what we call compelled speech. The First Amendment doesn't just protect your right to speak. It also protects your right not to speak. And that's what's at stake here.
Now, here in North Carolina, we are what's called a right-to-work state. So tell us why we would have an interest in this. And many other states are right-to-work states as well. Why would we care enough that we wanted to sign on to this?
Well, let me just, before I do that, I say that we're not just a right-to-work state. We're also a state which under state law forbids public employees from organizing, joining unions, and having the unions represent them through collective bargaining. We're very fortunate in that regard because in the states where unions do represent public employees, they tend to get more money gets spent on these people to the detriment of taxpayers. And the biggest problem is that they get outrageous pension arrangements, which many of these states are now finding that they're unsustainable. They don't know how they're going to fulfill their pension obligations. We're in much better shape than most states, primarily because we have a law that forbids collective bargaining for public employees. We nevertheless support this brief, and we want the Supreme Court to take up this case for two reasons. One is, of course, we may not always be so lucky. There are plenty of people on the left, plenty of Democrats who, as well as their supporters in the public employee arena, who would love to see the law changed. We might one day get to the point in North Carolina where we do have public employee unions. And in that case, this will be directly relevant to us. But more than that, there's a principle at stake here. It's the First Amendment to the Constitution. People should not be compelled to have words put in their mouth, in effect, that they don't agree with. It's compelled speech and it's forbidden by law.
Well, John, if we are urging the U.S. Supreme Court, we, the John Locke Foundation, to take up this case along with these other groups, there must be a level of confidence that the court would rule in favor of workers' rights in terms of freedom. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I suppose it makes sense. But just speaking just for myself, I don't have a great deal of confidence that that's how the court will decide. I think this is actually it could go either way, because up until now, the Supreme Court and the courts in general have not liked the idea of preventing union representation. The thought has always been that even though it compromises some constitutional principles, preventing labor unrest is such an important government interest that it can somehow override the First Amendment. Now, we don't agree with that. I would hope the Supreme Court wouldn't agree with it either, but I don't have a lot of confidence. I think it could go either way.
It sounds like you're referring to a phrase called labor peace that is part of the legal history on this issue.
Well, that's right. I mean, the unions have gotten away with a lot of things over the years that ordinarily would be illegal, but the feeling has been better to make some compromises under law than to have too much labor unrest that would disrupt the economy and make problems that would set us back so far that we want to make this compromise.
Now, a couple of years ago, in a case referred to as Janus, there was some progress in this area from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, it was an enormous step forward because at least it meant that public employees didn't have to pay for this representation. I mean, it's bad enough to have words put in your mouth, but for you to actually have to pay the speaker to make those statements you disagree with.
Insult to injury.
Insult to injury.
So if that's the case, then it sounds like Janus took one step. But if the court decides to take up Professor Reisman's case, it would be another step.
It would. It would be the other shoe, as they say, and it would be great. It would be where we think we ought to be when it comes to union representation. We hope they take it up, and we hope they decide the right way.
Now, John, this may sound a little bit naive on my part because I'm not an attorney, nor am I a legal scholar, but it seems odd to me that we would have to be fighting in this day and age, 2020, about something so fundamental to who we are as a country as the First Amendment.
Sadly, Donna, we have to fight all the time to vindicate our rights under all 10 of the amendments in the Bill of Rights. That's just the world we're living in today. We make progress, but we also have setbacks, and it's just the way it is.
The whole union movement is a fascinating one across the country because as I read stories about it, it appears that unions in the private sector have dropped dramatically, membership there. But in the public sector, that's where you're seeing more growth and you're seeing this robust effort by those successful public unions to try to spread the union power.
That's right. Unions have become a negligible force in the economy everywhere except in the public sector. And it's this collusion between the public employees and the unions and the legislatures, frankly, to the expense of the taxpayers and the public that we need to prevent. And that's why we hope the court will take up this case.
Friend of the court brief, amicus brief. It's not the first time that the John Locke Foundation has signed on to one. What role do they play when it comes to the U.S. Supreme Court considering what to do, whether to take up a case or not?
Well, they have a lot of persuasive impact, I think, especially when there are many amici or when there are many who join a brief as this one does. They want, if they see that this is an important issue to the general public and to the organizations they have confidence in, it can make a difference of whether they accept a case.
Any idea when we might hear one way or the other on this?
I don't really. It's going to be months, but it'll be interesting to see how it turns out.
We'll have you back once there's a decision.
I look forward to it.
John Guzet is Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The concept called social justice is having a major impact on American higher education. And while the term might sound good, in practice, social justice is having a major negative impact on colleges and universities. The National Association of Scholars is helping to expose that impact, and President Peter Wood joins us now to discuss how. Welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here.
So social justice, we've probably all heard the term, and it has had an impact on colleges and universities across the United States. You have a new report that focuses on this. Tell us about it, please.
Well, the report is titled, naturally enough, Social Justice Education in America. It's been almost 10 years in the making. We've been working on this a long, long time. It took so long because the project just sprawls all over the place. There is no aspect of a college or university that is now not touched by, infiltrated, shaped by the advocates of social justice. What are they doing with all of this emphasis? They're trying to turn students into political activists. The real purpose of the social justice movement is to transform students from learners of whatever subjects they choose to study into acolytes of this broader political movement.
Some people might be hearing us and saying, yeah, that sounds like hyperbole. That can't really be happening. Just this, how true is this?
Well, I think people rightly are skeptical about generalizations like that. So what they ought to do if they are skeptical is maybe look up the college catalog of their own alma mater, check out what changes have been made in the mission statement, look at what are now required courses, look at courses that they remember taking as undergraduates and reading the course descriptions that are there now. This is not hyperbole. This is a deep-seated transformation of education in America.
Your report, I understand, looked at more than 60 colleges and universities across the country. As you were studying this, tell us a little bit more about what you found. How is social justice infiltrating just about everything?
Well, I just mentioned one of the ways. Colleges used to have mission statements that said things like, we're here to promote Western civilization, the formation of good character, the making of good citizens. Nowadays, a lot of those statements have been amended to say that the basic purpose of the college is to promote social justice, not education, social justice. How does it move on from there? Well, there are specific administrators whose tasks are connected to the social justice movement. The Title IX administrators who supposedly are looking out for cases of harassment on sexual misconduct of various sorts are in fact social justice advocates. The people who are looking at environmental issues see themselves as primarily social justice advocates. You name the topic and there is a social justice angle to it. Sometimes that's embedded in the bureaucracy of the university. Oftentimes it's built into the criteria by which new faculty members are picked. There are student clubs galore, that is, student groups that are not self-invented. They tend to be organized by the dean of students or people working in that area so that the students buy into this early on. There's a lot of work done to make students into volunteers. Volunteers for what? Well, for social justice causes. So that's what it looks like on the sort of ground level. It's coming in other ways as well. There are accreditors now that regard pursuing social justice as part of the broader mission of higher education. And if your college and university isn't doing enough, you're going to get slammed by an accreditor. So external forces are behind it as well. During the Obama administration, there was a lot of weaponizing of regulations to aim at promoting social justice.
We are chatting with Peter Wood. He is president of the National Association of Scholars, a group taking a look, as you've just heard, about the impact of social justice on American colleges and universities. How does this change detract from students getting what has been a traditional higher education?
Well, I think it detracts in several ways. First of all, the students who go to college thinking that they're there to learn skills that will enable them to move on in life, get a good job, have a career, find themselves to some degree having that displaced by an emphasis on what kind of political action you should undertake. Well, some students get diverted entirely from their careers and slotted into this new social justice program. But even those who don't get pulled that far off their course find a lot of their time and money wasted. So there's that aspect of it. Then there's the question of what do you learn in your typical classroom about how to read and how to write and how to go about learning history. All of those things are now put through the distorting lens of social justice. So the books that you will read in an English course are books that are now picked to promote this cause. Classic works are generally either removed from the curriculum or reread through this very special angle of things. Every subject, and even ones that you might not think it would be possible to put through this sieve, are there. We have a kind of social justice mathematics now, and social justice medieval studies, worlds apart from what one might think is the proper place to talk about contentious political issues. Those issues are being forced into the curriculum.
You spent a lot of time and effort to put forward this report. What do you hope happens once people have a chance to read it?
Well, we are always hopeful that the American public will begin to awaken itself to the grievous loss of the quality of American higher education. I think that has been happening. We know from polls that larger and larger percentages of the American public now look upon college as a dubious enterprise, very expensive and delivering not very much that's worthwhile. So getting public opinion on your side is part of what we're aiming to do, but we're also looking at ways in which we can convince state legislators and boards of regents, people in positions of real influence, to shake off their slumber about this. North Carolina happens to be one of the places where that does seem to be happening, where you have a legislature here that is taking a hard look at what has been going on in the state colleges and universities. Of course, I should say this is not just a disease of the public colleges and universities, but those are the institutions that can be most quickly and easily reached by the political means at our disposal.
In the brief time that we have left, if nothing is done and the social justice infiltration, as you described it, continues, what is that going to mean for the long-term impact on American higher education?
Well, American higher education has already forfeited a lot of its credibility. It has become a subsidiary of the progressive left. It hangs on in places like engineering departments and schools of business that have some natural resistance to that, but even they are being slowly converted into agents of this broader cause.
You can read the full report on social justice education in America. It comes from the National Association of Scholars. We have been chatting with that association's president, Peter Wood. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
And we'll have more Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers came back to Raleigh for a single day in January. Republican Representative Julia Howard hoped her colleagues would pass a bill to link North Carolina tax law to a federal change.
The North Carolina tax code will not incorporate these changes for state tax purposes until we do an IRC update and have that update enacted. One of the most important parts of the provisions is one dealing with medical exemptions and able to take certain provisions off of your income tax. And the currently, the way the tax bill is right now, you can go to 10% limitation of your taxable income for medical exemptions, but the new bill will change that to 7.5%, which is an enhancement for people with particularly high medical exemptions.
Republican Representative Keith Kidwell endorsed Howard's plan.
It's a very important issue that we recouple ourselves to the federal laws on this. For those that are not aware, which I suspect is very few, this is my business and my life. I'm actually an enrolled agent licensed by Treasury to represent the American taxpayer. This is something that we absolutely need to get done. I would ask that we impress upon the Senate that they go ahead and get this passed. We do not want to have a situation where our taxpayers cannot take what's allowed on the federal return in a medical deduction. They would have to go back and file an amended return at additional cost. Generally, that cost is not going to be enough to offset what they might have saved on some of the smaller accounts in these medical deductions. It is the right thing to do. Our tax system is supposed to be equitable. If we don't recouple this immediately to the Fed, we will not be equitable. That would not be a responsible act by this body or by the Senate.
Why act quickly? Representative Julia Howard offered an answer.
The taxpayers of the state don't have to ask for an extension of their income tax filing, nor do they have to do an amended return. And both of those provisions are costly and time-consuming. I hope and I pray that the Senate will have the light of day to do the right thing. And while we're all here, it takes one vote over there. It's a Senate bill that's already passed over there, and so they would just need to concur with the changes that we made. It's a very simple thing for them to do, and it's the right thing to do for all the taxpayers of the state.
The House passed the bill unanimously. The Senate, its members, decided to wait until the General Assembly reconvenes in the spring. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. The taxpayers in a community pay the bills for the local government, but very few of those taxpayers play a role in writing the budget that generates those bills. That's usually left to an elected board and its professional staff. But there is a growing movement called participatory budgeting, or PB, and our next guest is here to discuss it. Dr. Whitney Alfonso is Associate Professor of Public Administration and Government at the UNC School of Government. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, participatory budgeting. Tell us what this is all about.
So participatory budgeting, or PB as I will call it, is really the process where the government will allocate a certain amount of dollars to the community, solicit proposals and project ideas from the community directly, and then after deciding on and finding out which ones are the most popular and then vetting those projects to see if they are doable, feasible, legal, and within the allotted amount of money, they put them forward for direct vote from citizens and residents, which may be broadly defined in their community. And so ultimately, the citizens both generate the ideas and then select which projects will be funded by government.
Governments have been making budgets for hundreds of years. This is a relatively recent phenomenon.
It is. It started in the late 1980s in a small town in Brazil, who allocated quite a bit of its budget to the PB process. 17%, in fact. And so in Brazil, it has become very common. 3% of jurisdictions and municipalities in Brazil have some sort of PB. And it has been relatively quickly spreading internationally. Over 1,500 communities have PB in place. And in the U.S., we're seeing it become more and more common. The first case of PB was in Chicago in one of the wards in 2009. And now it has gone throughout the country. And we now have even two cities doing PB in North Carolina, Greensboro and Durham.
We'll talk a little bit about the local Greensboro and Durham connection in just a bit, but let's talk about what are seen as some of the potential benefits of doing this. Why would anyone, especially those who are in control of the dollars, why would they want to give up some of that control?
So participatory budgeting, like a lot of forms of citizen engagement, has quite a few goals and quite a few things that it's trying to accomplish. Advocates of participatory budgeting say that this is a way to involve citizens, often that have never had positive experiences and interactions with government, in a process that gives them control and an autonomy in this process. Also, it really comes down to identifying pressing needs, preferences, and even potentially innovations from your citizens. They know what they want. They know what they're missing. And PB gives them a way to have that voice heard.
We're speaking with Dr. Whitney Afonso, who is a professor at the UNC School of Government. As someone who looks at these types of issues, you've also seen that there can be some potential concerns about PB. What are some of those?
So first of all, is it necessary? Governments have a lot of ways that they actively are engaging with citizens already. In many places, this may already be giving grants to community projects or having neighborhood councils to make sure that it's not just the squeaky wheel that is getting the grease, which is one of the concerns of any type of citizen engagement, to be frank. But beyond that, often we're seeing relatively minor investments. There are quite a few limitations to what we can do with PB. Typically, it's capital projects so that it's just a one-term cost, some sort of small infrastructure. And that's because it's not a commitment from the government to be funding this project for many years. So we limit it to one term, one year, one annual project. Also, because sometimes these dollars are not immense, it's very small projects. We see a lot of community gardens. We see playground equipment. And while those things are wonderful and there is demand for citizens to be investing in these communities, is this the best use of those dollars? The opportunity cost of that money is a big one. It's taking time and staff resources from government, it's taking time and resources from citizens to engage. And if we're getting small changes that may not be making a big impact, there are those that question whether this is the best use of our time and dollars.
Greensboro and Durham, at least at this point, have decided this is a good use of some of the tax dollars. Tell us a little bit about what has been learned in those two communities.
So Greensboro and Durham have done it actually relatively differently. Both have done a traditional participatory budgeting model. Greensboro actually is the first city in the Southeast United States to adopt participatory budgeting, and they give $100,000 to each of their five districts. And that way they can make sure that it's not just one district's needs that are dominating the entire budget process. But they have limited to $100,000. And so they have gone through two cycles at this point, and they're getting inclusive playground equipment, bus shelters and covered bus shelters, solar charging stations in parks, projects like that that are absolutely meeting community needs and have been identified by the community, but are that typical small infrastructure piece. Durham only recently started theirs in 2018, and they are currently implementing the projects that have won in their first cycle. They, however, went and dedicated $2.4 million. So each of their zones is getting $800,000. So what you've seen come out of Durham are actually larger scale projects. They have allowed for some citywide projects to emerge, youth centers, technology for some of the public schools. And so what you might consider bigger ticket items coming out of Durham, but once again, the one-time costs and largely for capital.
As an expert and a scholar, what are some of the things about participatory budgeting that you're going to be watching as these two communities and maybe some others in North Carolina look at this?
So I think one of the important things to keep an eye on is engagement. One of the many goals of participatory budgeting is to engage citizens. You also hope that is going to lead to innovations and better outcomes with those budget dollars. But one of the goals really is to build relationships with citizens. And so you need to be very mindful of what parts of the populations are being reached, which parts of the populations maybe aren't engaging with the process. Are you finding that you're getting more engagement as time grows on and more strategic choices being made that maybe build off of each other? Or is participation starting to wane? In some communities that have had a PB process, there's low-hanging fruit that people are excited about to get done. But in the years following it, interest tends to get thinner and fewer people engage with the process. And so that's not true everywhere. New York, for example, they are increasing participation, but you want to be mindful of what trajectory your community is on and make sure you're accomplishing the goals that you as a government have laid out, but also what goals your citizens want out of this process.
Well, it's certainly a very interesting topic, and we know that one person who's going to be watching very closely as Greensboro, Durham, and other communities move forward with participatory budgeting, or PB, is Dr. Whitney Afonso, Associate Professor of Public Administration and Government at the UNC School of Government. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina is a right-to-work state, but danger to that status could be coming our way in federal legislation called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. So exactly what is in this federal bill? Well, one of the people who is making sure he knows all about that is our own John Sanders. He is the Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
First of all, help us understand really what it means to say that North Carolina is a right-to-work state.
Yeah, basically, it means that a person cannot be compelled to join and then pay dues to a union.
Okay, so that has been something that has been North Carolina law for decades, right?
Right, since 1947.
Okay, but it's also something that is at least referenced in terms of ideas in the North Carolina Constitution, which goes way, way back.
Oh, yeah. Our Constitution protects alongside the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but the right to an individual to the fruits of their own labor.
And so that's where you make the connection. I know you like to refer to a lot of things back to the North Carolina Constitution in terms of how
frequently that we are addressing issues in which some people would like to go astray from the Constitution. So
yeah, I like that because those terms are originally from the Declaration of Independence, but we have codified them in our Constitution. That's how important they are to us.
Now, you've been following this federal legislation called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. Tell us about that.
That is a massive union power grab. It's just a really, you know, it's kind of like their grand scheme. That bill would make it illegal to be a right to work state, essentially. And then it would go further by making it very difficult to be a contract worker. So if everything goes to plan, it basically would mean that almost anybody would have to be coerced into, could be coerced into a union and have union dues taken from them against their will.
How would that jive then with North Carolina being a right to work state? How would it become illegal?
Well, it would change the law so that North Carolina and the other 27 right to work states could no longer be right to work states.
Now, that's pretty amazing. One would presume, since 28 states are right-to-work states, that this is getting a lot of attention, maybe some pushback. How did this even kind of make it through the U.S. House of Representatives?
It's definitely getting a lot of attention, and the contract worker stuff has been getting a lot of attention since a law passed in California this past fall that just has that aspect of it and could bear several billion dollars worth of negative economic impact for that state.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because a lot of people, if you're a full-time employee, you get your check either once a month or once every 2 weeks, something like that. But if you are an independent contractor, it's a completely different thing. Help us understand how an independent contractor functions and then how this bill would impact that.
Well, you're basically in service to yourself. It could be anything. You could be a truck driver. You could be a freelancer. You could decide to work for Uber or on the side. It's anything from full-time work, where you're trusting in your own skills and abilities to trying to make a little buck on the side.
And then taxes, you have to take care of your own
right.
taxes.
You're paying
your employer
own taxes.
Doesn't take
yeah.
out your taxes, yes. et cetera. So you are an independent entity, hence independent contractor.
Right.
So it's up to you to do those things. Well, how would this bill impact that?
The bill basically would apply a three-part test to companies who are hiring an independent contractor. And the assumption is, unless they can pass all three parts of that test, is that you are an employee of that company. And if you are an employee, then you are therefore subject to whether that company is a union shop or not and whether union dues can be taken from you.
But presumably, at least some of the people who are independent contractors don't want to be employees. Maybe it's a nighttime gig in the case of, you know, driving for one of the services.
Right. A lot of people like the freedom of that. And they right. also like the freedom to just go pursue something after hours.
Right. So what is the idea then behind taking away someone's ability to choose what they want to do with their time and how they want to earn money?
Well, from the union's perspective, they see it as if you are in a union shop but in a right-to-work state and you have not joined the union and you're not paying the dues, then you're a freeloader. Because
meaning
you're,
what?
You're benefiting – in their perspective, you're benefiting from union representation without having to give them any money. Now, from the free market perspective, if they are taking money from you, they're freeloading off of you, especially if you don't want their help, you don't want their representation, you don't want to give money to them, and you don't want to give money to their causes, which may be against your political proclivities.
You know, this whole sharing economy, and I guess some people call it the gig economy, it seems like it's growing, seems to be working for a lot of people, and market forces are at play, and consumers win in this kind of thing. You get more choices, maybe pressure to lower prices, whether it's to get transportation from one point to another, or I've even heard of some more emerging markets in the sharing economy, like with movers, or if you just want someone to come in and, you know, put some posters on the wall in your apartment, you can instantly do this. So that's growing. It seems odd then that there would be a group of people who want to crack down on that, because with growth comes opportunity.
It surprises me, too. And I think it's sort of like they're trying to apply a 20th century model of collectivism on this new economy on a completely different world. I mean, we couldn't have even 15 years ago envisioned where we could have a smartphone and be able to connect someone who needs their dog walked. And someone who likes to walk dogs, or someone who wants some crafts, and someone who likes to make crafts for somebody, someone who wants to do home improvement projects on the side for people, and, you know, someone who needs some help with that.
You know, John, in the broader sense, this bill sounds really like a danger, and I don't think that's too strong of a word to use, because talk a little bit more about the potential impact on North Carolina should this bill prevail. Right now, it has made its way through the U.S. House of Representatives, but it would have to go over to the United States Senate, and there's probably not a whole lot of people there who would be interested in passing this just because of the political nature, the differences between the House and the Senate. But let's just say it did pass. What would that mean?
Boy, that's a hard one to guess. I mean, for California, just the contract worker side of it, they were projecting losses of like $4 to $6 billion from the economy. For North Carolina, being a right to work state, it would impose some significant costs on employees and the economy. And then when you consider the platform economy, you're talking about all of these things that people have not even envisioned. That could be strangled, these ideas that could be stopped before someone even would have had a chance to come up with it. So I have no idea.
It seems
but
like
it would not be good.
It seems like it's just one more kind of piece of this puzzle that shows North Carolina is not only a political battleground state, but we seem to be a battleground for the union movement. They really seem to want to get into North Carolina and do away with this right to work status.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why we may have to go beyond just having our law and push for a constitutional amendment so that we would have a stronger basis to stand on if that ever passed.
Well, again, it is called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. It would have a big impact on right-to-work states like North Carolina. John Sanders is Director of Regulatory Studies for the Locke Foundation. John, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.